From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made sometime in the spring semester on a New York college campus last year. A female student, 19 years old, was drinking at a party. She got drunk, and later that night, she was raped. But the student was scared to tell anyone because she knew she shouldn't have been drinking in the first place, so the case goes unreported. Sound familiar? Fear of punishment is just one of many barriers that prevent the majority of sexual assaults on campuses from being reported. So on December 2, 2014, Governor Andrew Cuomo announced a new set of standards in handling campus sexual assault on SUNY campuses. Included among those standards was an amnesty clause that means a student reporting an incident of sexual assault of any kind is granted immunity for drug or alcohol violations. Well, that's just one part of reform standards for SUNY, and now the governor wants all private institutions in New York State to adopt them as well. They include a verbalized consent to sexual activity, a so-called yes means yes provision. Across the country, colleges and universities are grappling with the problem of sexual assault on campus, what to do about it. This hour, we're looking at Title IX as it relates to sexual violence on campuses. We're looking at how a uniform policy across public and private institutions could impact victims and the rate of reporting. My guests for the hour include Christopher Thomas, a partner with Nixon Peabody. Christopher, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Catherine Cerulli is with the University of Rochester Susan B. Anthony Center for Women's Leadership. Kate, nice to have you back.
Thank you.
And also here is Morgan Levy, University of Rochester Compliance and Title IX Coordinator. Morgan, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Let's start with this on amnesty clauses. To me, that looks like a significant barrier. And we, before the hour started, Morgan and I were talking about the fact that in practice, Morgan, probably fair to say that most campuses these days are not punishing victims. Let's say it's the 19-year-old we talked about who was drunk, was assaulted in some way. You're not going to get punished for drinking. But this codification, could it help?
I think so. I think that it really is a best practice at most colleges and universities not to charge a student who's coming forward with a complaint for a violation of the alcohol or the drug policy. But students who are coming to a university for the first time may not realize that that is the practice. So having that in writing when they get there is probably going to help.
Okay. Kate Cerulli, what do you think about that?
I think that's just one of the barriers that's been cited. There's other barriers such as EOBs, which is explanation of benefits. Some students are afraid to come forward and have sex assault exams for fear that their parents will get medical bills in the mail or explanations of a procedure that's happened. I think there's the stigma barrier. I think amnesty clauses will only help so far.
Okay. And when we look at what changed in December and what could change for private institutions, I hope I'm setting the landscape correctly for our listeners, Morgan, when it comes to SUNY and then maybe the state expanding it privately. Is that right?
That's right. So SUNY's already adopted the procedures that are outlined in the legislation, and it's currently being proposed for all private colleges and universities to adopt them as well.
Private institutions probably have a varied set of ways of dealing with this. Are some closer to already being at that SUNY standard that we saw in December?
Absolutely. I think there's a lot of schools that actually looked at this legislation and thought we're already doing most of these things, so it wouldn't be a total sea change to implement them on our campuses. But depending on the size of the school, every school has different resources that are available to them. So there may be some schools that aren't quite up to this aspect of best practices.
Okay. And so the notion of whether it can apply to private institutions, that's not a stretch, as Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul said in this program. In fact, if we could, John, do we have Kathy Hochul's comment? Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul was on a couple of weeks ago, and I'd like to listen to some of the remarks she made about her interactions with private institutions and whether this is realistic for them, and also responding to some of the criticism that has been out there. And we're going to talk about that in a moment as well, some of the criticism of these proposed changes. Let's listen to Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul, and we'll come back and talk about it.
I just hosted a roundtable at Syracuse University last week. They have signed on 100% with this policy. So there are a lot of privates that are stepping up, but there's others who aren't. And this law would apply to everyone in the state, and we want to get it passed by June 17, the end of session. I have heard the voices of victims, survivors all across the state. When I lay out the governor's proposal, they are so grateful that Governor Cuomo has stepped up and says, we are putting the power in these young women, particularly women, and saying, you have a right to say no, but also there is no assumed consent. And that is liberating for them. They want to know that they have certain rights. And yes, there are people that are going to oppose this and have different points of view, but I'm going by what the survivors want, and they want their state government to protect them, and our governor wants to make sure the state of New York is number one in the nation in protecting young women, and in some cases young men, from sexual assault on campuses.
That's Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul on this program just a couple of weeks ago. Now, when we look at the more controversial parts of this, I say controversial because there's been some dissent. You heard Kathy Hochul talking about affirmative consent, and some of the critics have said the so-called yes means yes portion is too hard to define, and potentially makes it skewed in favor of ostensible victims and makes the alleged perpetrators be put in a very difficult legal spot. So, Morgan Levy, when we talk about yes means yes or affirmative consent, what does that mean legally?
Affirmative consent means that, you know, sort of in the most simple terms, that you're making the efforts to ensure that your partner wants to do the sexual activity that you are asking them to do. I reject that notion that it is pushing the burden too much on the person who's accused of the misconduct. I think that the affirmative consent policy is tremendously powerful for college communities and enclosed communities because it encourages us to set a standard for what communication in a sexual encounter looks like.
Okay, and already have our first comment from Pete, who says affirmative consent is just code for mood killer. Well, I don't know if that's fair, but I've heard that from some people saying, are you really going to be talking like that? Do we need, aren't there nonverbal cues? Do you really need a verbalized cue on this, Morgan?
And I don't think you do necessarily need the word. So I think that if both partners are consenting to that activity, if in the aftermath of that, one of the partners says, I didn't actually, the person who was engaging in the activity will be able to articulate, these were the behaviors that that person demonstrated to me that let me know that they were consenting to the activity. So I don't think you necessarily need to sort of press pause and have a really legalistic conversation about, do I have your affirmative consent to engage in this particular activity? Our best case scenario, I think, is that there's a conversation before any type of sexual activity starts, that there's a conversation before that first kiss, before the first encounter that says, hey, this is where I think we're going. Are you comfortable with that? Is this what you want to do at this moment?
Okay, well, this is where State Senator Ken LaValle, a Long Island Republican who chairs the State Senate's Higher Education Committee, steps in and says he disagrees that it's that simple or that this is a good idea. I want to read his quote, and we'll get your response to this. The senator says the following, quote, there are people who believe that consent should be given not only initially, but in some minds, consent needs to be given all the way through the process of the act. And then the issue is, so two people have sexual intercourse and consent has been given. Does that consent have to be given again the next day? Is it a lifelong consent? Is it consent on Friday but not on Saturday? Does it have to be renewed? There are a lot of questions here. And to those people who say it has to be ongoing, it's not a practical matter to say in a half an hour event that you have to give it five or six times along the way. That is just not practical as a legal standard. Morgan?
I think that the way that he's describing it makes us envision pausing every 5 seconds and asking another question.
And you're saying that's not what's actually being proposed?
No, I don't think that is what's being proposed. I think that really what's being proposed is that people have respectful, open conversations about what type of activity they want to engage in. I do think it's possible for partners in a sexual relationship to be able to come to a mutual understanding, not necessarily with those spoken words every single moment of the encounter. I think that you'd be able to demonstrate, reflecting back upon the experience, that I had consent and these are the ways that my partner mm-hmm. showed me that I had consent without there needing to be particular words. And I absolutely agree that it needs to be a new conversation each time. Every person, when they're engaging in a sexual act, should want to make sure that their partner actually wants to do those things with them prior than them moving forward.
We're talking to Morgan Levy, who's the University of Rochester Compliance and Title IX Coordinator. Let me ask the same kind of questions on the criticism that we've heard from not only the state senator, but for some other voices criticizing these proposals, from Kate Cerulli, University of Rochester, Susan B. Anthony Center for Women's Leadership. Kate, concerned about those criticisms?
Well, I have a couple of thoughts about that. You know, as you know, I'm also with the Laboratory of Interpersonal Violence and Victimization, where we do studies and we read reports that are coming out. And I think it's important that we put this college campus assault issue into the 20,000-foot view, which is the rates are similar in college campuses. We've heard about clergy rape, military rape. You're hearing all these names that are being put before an act of rape almost to segregate it and divide it. The truth is rape is rape is rape regardless of where it happens, right? So this legislation is trying to move the needle on an issue that affects people everywhere in all environments. And I think the goal of the legislation is to have a cultural shift, as Morgan said, on a closed environment, which is a closed campus, where we can control certain elements of people's experiences there. I think this notion of consent, as Morgan said, is about a mutual respect and relationship. And I think it's important for people to know this stranger danger concept of college rape, where it's happening at a party and you don't know the people, and it's actually, the statistics will show, the large majority of reports of sexual assault on campuses are between people who know each other and that have happened in what would be called a dating circumstance or a dating relationship. So when critics say, does it need to be ongoing and do you have to have the dialogue on a Friday and a Sunday and a Monday? I would argue as an advocate, yes, every act of sexual touching or intercourse should be consensual, and that consent should be discussed. Again, not in a legalistic, formulaic way. But we're really pushing a cultural paradigm shift. And I think that anytime you have legislation that's trying to push a culture shift, the dialogue has to be broader than 4 years on college campuses. We've got to be talking about middle school education, healthy dating relationships in high school. Monroe County's been doing that for a long time through ABW, formerly now Willow. The conversation has to be about healthy relationships. It's too late by time our kids are 20, 21, and 22 on college campuses.
Well, on that note, next hour we're going to have the folks from Willow. It used to be Alternatives for Battered Women. They're now called Willow Domestic Violence Center, and we're going to have them on next hour talking about their broadening mission and looking outside of the campuses, as Kate Cerulli says there, that this question does pertain to so much more than just what happens on a college campus. But a number of our listeners this morning on Twitter and elsewhere were saying that these are not just they're saying essentially, this is not just theory. This is not just a thought experiment. There are questions over legal cases right now. And Chris Thomas with Nixon Peabody, for those who look around saying, well, are there actually cases where a couple wakes up the next morning and one of the partners says, did I commit a sexual assault? Are you accusing me? There's that much uncertainty. Those cases have happened already.
Already. That's the majority of the cases that are out there. There was, in about 2012, about 12 cases that had been, these are civil cases, brought in federal district courts alleging exactly that. The number has exploded such that in 2014, there's more than 100 cases that have been brought. And the majority of them deal with that same situation. In fact, there was one that was recently decided coming out of Vassar College, a young man named Peter Yu. And he and his teammate on the crew team were both highly intoxicated. And what I think we ought to remind all of our listeners, especially those who are in college and those who have kids or grandkids in college, is the vast majority of these cases, involve alcohol by both parties. And the U case was similar. So the two teammates had become really intoxicated. They had sexual intercourse that evening. The next morning, as kids do these days, they traded Facebook messages. And the Facebook messages were, I had a great time with you last night, said the female. And I'm sorry if I led you on a little bit, but I had a great time. The male said, well, you know, I had a great time too. About a year later, she brought charges in the university setting that it was not a consensual act. And Vassar expelled you, even though the evidence was from these Facebook postings that it was a fairly consensual act. But over the course of time, as she reflected on it, she decided that it was not. As I said, Vassar expelled you, and in a 56-page decision, the federal district court said Vassar was within its rights to expel him. So it's a serious issue. It ties back into what you were just saying.
And I don't mean I've got to be careful here because I know how sensitive this subject is, but I know some listeners are going to hear the story that Chris just told and think, that's crazy. This guy is going to be affected the rest of his life. It doesn't sound like it was not consensual. And now the case is loaded against possible perpetrators. I'm not making that point, but I know people have said it. Morgan, is the system becoming loaded against what is typically males? It's not always males. We know that's not always males. But is the system becoming loaded against possible perpetrators? Or is it fair?
I think that it is fair. I think that there are higher expectations about consent, about getting consent. There's more stringent rules about what it is like to engage in a sexual encounter on college campuses in particular. And we're seeing that reflected in more students being held accountable through conduct processes for sexual assault. And with the U case in particular, I read that 56-page opinion. It was very long.
Yeah.
And it really did outline a number of circumstances that I think that the average person outside of, you know, the intricacies of that case would say, it really feels like the evidence that the case should have gone the other way. But we weren't in that hearing room. We didn't hear all the testimony of the students who participated. We don't know, you know, fully what the rationale was. And I think that one of the obligations of federal laws recently related to sexual misconduct is that we have trauma-informed processes, and so that we recognize that sometimes someone may experience something and feel afterwards that, I don't know what just happened, I don't really feel that comfortable with it, but I'm just going to keep going on in my life. And then it takes a little while for that to catch up to them, and when they do reflect back, they recognize that something happened to me that I was not comfortable with, and they move forward with a process. Because there's a gap between when an incident happened and when it was reported, or because the victim doesn't act in a way that we stereotypically believe victims should act, that doesn't mean that they didn't experience something really bad during that circumstance.
And that's a concept that has been understood in the criminal courts for a long time. I have, as a defense attorney, handled cases where the victim didn't come forward for weeks and months. It's a tool that the defense attorney gets to use to undermine credibility and point to consent, but it is also recognized in the science and the literature that that, in fact, does occur. The important thing here to understand, and for your listeners to, I think, understand, is this. In this academic setting, the standard of proof is not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. In criminal court, it is proof beyond a reasonable doubt, the highest, most stringent standard that there is out there. Why? Because people go to jail. They lose their liberty if they are convicted in criminal court. In these academic proceedings, no one's going to jail. The worst thing, and I'm not saying it's not a bad thing, but the worst thing that's going to happen is you're going to get expelled like Peter Yu did. And for that reason, there's a much lower standard of proof that was passed and enacted by Congress, and that's preponderance of the evidence. What does that mean, Evan? It means more likely than not. 51% versus 49%. 50.5% versus 49.5%. So that's why you sometimes see these results, two radically different legal standards in those two settings.
Okay. There are some who would certainly argue, though, that getting thrown out of a college campus, that's going to follow you. It's not just losing your academic career at that institution.
And it does follow you. I've handled cases for institutions in this very town where the facts have not been dissimilar to what was confronted Mr. Yu, and the student was expelled, and the student was in one case, in his final semester of a PhD program. Yes, serious consequences, serious effects, and serious conduct.
And Morgan, is it also important to keep in mind, as we discuss the Yu case and others, we really don't know what went on. For those of us who haven't read all 56 pages of the report, yes, it sounds like consensual encounter. It sounds like a woman who took some time to reflect and decided maybe I didn't want to do that. And for those of us who haven't gotten into the details of the investigation, there's a lot we may not know.
Exactly. I think that it's there's been so much media and so much attention to this issue over the past 2 years that I'm worried about folks rushing to judgment related to the basic facts that they read in a quick news story.
Well, here's here's the other thing that, you know, the simple reality is courts give academic institutions very, very wide sway. So if an academic institution has determined that the preponderance of evidence standard has been met, courts essentially back off and say, as long as there wasn't something arbitrary or biased or improper that happened in that hearing, we're keeping our hands off it.
Okay. Kate?
I think, though, it's important to remember that for the victim who's coming forward, the nuances that Chris was just talking about are often lost. We're talking about young people who are sometimes for the first time on their own. When we talk about trauma-informed care, they have no idea who the responding officer is going to be, what level of training they've had. And we cannot underestimate the social pressure that victims have, both not only to report from their friends and sorority sisters mm-hmm. and people who are encouraging them, but the incredible pressure they have to not report. And that pressure often comes from family members and friends and teachers, because it is a life-changing, often not only event, but the consequences that flow from an investigation. And the pressure that they receive from the perpetrator's social network to recant or to decide to change their mind also can't be underestimated. You look at the Notre Dame St. Mary's case that happened a few years ago. The woman ended up taking her own life. The volume of text messages and threats that she got from the perpetrator's friends really played a role in that.
Before I grab my first phone call, and we're going to get to the phones in a moment here, I should mention, if you want to join the conversation with comments or questions, you can call toll-free 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Kate, there's no way to know exactly how many cases are reported and how many are not, but we still know that, at least we think we know that most are not, right?
That's correct. And when young people are speaking with me through the research that I do, and we do this research nationally. The reasons for not reporting are as unique and individual as each victim is. And I think to try to raise generalizations about victims is often very difficult, because what seems to be reasonable to those standing on the outside or a rational decision, a victim's decision may defy what we think is rational.
Let me grab Tim in Pittsford. Go ahead, Tim.
Well, Evan, I'm going to expand on what you said, and you are the host of the show, and you have to be polite, and I will be as polite as possible. But it seems like there's a lot of vagueness on here. Unless I just misheard, but all that has to be proven if you're in college is that something may have happened and you can be expelled. If that's my son at college, if he did something wrong, then he did something wrong. But if two kids hook up and we were all in college at one point, and the girl feels bad because she drank, or they both drank too much, and she did something that maybe she regrets, and something did happen, all she has to prove is that something may have happened, and he can get in trouble and get kicked out of school. Does he have a chance to represent himself in front of some sort of board? Because then when they're 22 years old and they're out in the real world, these rules don't really apply like that. There's no asking in the middle of the throes of the passion if this is okay, or I don't get that. There's just so much vagueness. 51%. I don't get this.
Okay.
So there's no
Tim.
He's going to have his life ruined. Let's not minimize that at all. You get kicked out of college, your life is going to change very, very significantly.
Okay, Tim, stay on the line, because I suspect your question is shared by a number of listeners. So let's kind of get our panel's take on what you had right or had wrong here. Chris Thomas first.
Okay, so first of all, Tim, great question, and I think it really does a good job of encapsulating what a lot of the concerns are out there. You should understand, however, that, you know, and I can tell you this from firsthand knowledge from having defended young men who have been charged with rape, that this also happens in the regular world, outside of the college campus, where there'll be an encounter that appears to one party to have been consensual, but the other party says that it was not, yet the DA is able to get an indictment and a conviction. So To the extent that you think that this is only an issue related to college campuses, and I know you weren't saying that, it's not. This is a life lesson we're talking about. And in terms of what's going on campuses, there is absolutely a heightened standard. That heightened, I should say, a lower evidentiary standard, which is a preponderance of the evidence. And I can tell you, Tim, I've got a son going off to college next year, and you know I'm having conversations with him about what consent looks like. And it's going to be keyed off of these new rules and regulations, and it's going to be having a very consistent and strong message about the use of alcohol by either party and specific conversations with him about what consent looks like in the eyes of not just the law, but not just the criminal law, but in terms of the academic institution he's going to be going to. I'd like to hear what Morgan has to say.
I know Tim's going to want to follow up, but let's get Morgan Levy again. If you're just joining us, Morgan is the University of Rochester Compliance and Title IX Coordinator. Go ahead, Morgan.
I think that every school has, so each school has different approaches to how they're going to handle sexual misconduct cases. But particularly in the past couple of years, schools are really on notice that they need to do a pretty intense and thorough investigation of those allegations. So it's not as though someone can just come into a room and accuse, you know, one of their peers of sexually assaulting them and the school says, okay, that sounds right, and then they're expelled. There's a pretty robust process. The University of Rochester, our public safety office, thoroughly investigates every allegation in which the student says that they want to move forward with the university investigating. There are circumstances where students come forward and say they don't want the university to investigate. But in those cases where we do move forward with our process, we get a huge packet of investigative materials, interviews with witnesses, interviews with both of the parties to the sexual activity. All this information is presented to a hearing board, which has gone through robust training, full day training, plus monthly meetings to make sure that they are on top of the issue and really understand how to analyze the evidence that's been presented to them. Both the students have the opportunity to present their case, their story, and present witnesses to all of the witnesses and the other party. So it really is a very robust process, and there's appeals that are available. Students can be represented by attorneys. It isn't just an arbitrary, we're going to just believe one person's story over another. There's actually quite a lot of critical thought that goes into making these decisions.
And Kate?
Well, and I think I too have a son going off to college in the fall. And one of the things that I think about, of course, is you don't want any young person's life ruined. And while we think about a perpetrator who has been convicted in a college judiciary to be removed, we have to realize the lifetime consequences that victims have, things like PTSD impacting their educational abilities to complete college. We have many rape victims who often take time off of college. They'll take a semester away or a semester out. Some have transferred universities altogether. They can't stay in the environment where the event occurred. So, you know, there are lifetime consequences on both sides of the fence that need to be considered.
Tim, what do you think?
Jeez, I don't know. I've got a daughter and two sons, and I shouldn't say I'm scared, but you don't want anything to happen to your daughter as a father. But now at the same time, what do I mean, I try and educate my kids when they go, but I'm a realist. I was 19, 20 in college, and you know what the big thing is alcohol. And then after that, someone remembers one thing and someone may not remember something at all, and it ends up turning into a he said, she said. And I'm pretty sure the majority of the time it's the she said part that really, I mean, if something happens terrible and the person should pay for that. But the majority of the time I would think that these cases go in favor of the girl who's accusing the boy of whatever happened. But in the end, it's alcohol. I mean, we all know it. It's alcohol. That's the majority of the time that's what it is with kids this age.
Tim, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Kate.
Tim, you know, one of the things when I hear you say that you're scared about having your kids go off, I talk to a lot of parents and we have these similar discussions. And one of the things I want to be really clear on the radio, I'm not advocating is sort of a scare tactic or a stranger danger perception of strangers lurking on college campuses or elsewhere. And I think the reason I talk about educating people earlier on is this is about common sense approaches to talking to our children. When we talk to our kids about keeping gas in their car and being sure they balance their checkbooks and being sure they register for classes on time, we need to be talking about personal safety and personal accountability in that same venue, and opening a dialogue for conversation. If I told you how many young people say to me, well, I was on this date, this person kind of tweaked me, there's something not quite right, and my own, they don't trust their own red flags. And I think what we have to do is instill in young people, trust your gut, trust your red flags, have good friends, have bystander mentality. If you see something going down that seems off, do something about it. Step in, be a stand-up guy or a stand-up woman and make a statement and help your friend out. But I think it's really preparing our children to be launched for life and not just college, because as Chris said, these things happen in the workplace. They happen when you travel. They happen in hotels, in bars. They happen everywhere.
Last question, last point on Tim's call before we get to some of our other callers, and we've got more ground to cover here. But Tim was finishing his point, I think, by saying a lot of the encounters that we are talking about right now seem to be alcohol-fueled and then regret. Regret but not assault is what Tim seems to be wondering, at least. And I'm not saying it is or it isn't, but I guess what we're hearing from the panel here is that the process isn't as simple as a woman walks into an office and says, I regretted sleeping with so-and-so. I wish I hadn't. I'm going to say it was rape, and therefore he's off the campus. Morgan Levy, it's not quite that simple.
It's definitely not that simple. And I wanted to touch upon the alcohol conversation a little bit more. So I've done this work at the University of Rochester for almost seven years. I've also worked at Columbia and NYU, and I started off at SUNY Buffalo, and have unfortunately had the experience of hearing many cases over my career. And in almost every single case, both parties were, if not a little bit drunk, intoxicated from their perspective. And neither one of them has a good recollection of what happened the day before. And often they wake up confused about what happened that night, which is why we look to witnesses. We look to other people who may have observed the behaviors of both of those parties before they engaged in the sexual activity to try to get a sense of what actually happened that night. But it is immensely complicated by alcohol. I think that the amount of drinking that happens in connection with sex on college campuses is problematic.
Okay. And in the U case, I think the U case is probably an extreme. I don't know. I say an extreme in the way it's characterized in the media without having read all the details. But it is possible, based on the law and based on the way campuses adjudicate these things, it is possible for male and female to have sex one night after drinking, and the next day they wake up, they message each other on Facebook, I had a great time last night, so did I. Didn't mean to lead you on a little bit, but hey, I had fun, so did I. And then months later, it is deemed to be a sexual assault. That is still within the realm of possibility because it happened, and that doesn't mean it wasn't sexual assault, Morgan, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so a lot to consider. Let's get our short break in, and then your phone calls, and we're going to try to cover as much ground as we can talking about the current legal landscape of sexual assault on campus, the proposals, and what might be changing. Short break, and your calls next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we're talking about violence in general and domestic violence specifically. So from sexual assault on campus to domestic violence in our second hour, and why it is not just simply a women's issue. We'll talk to a man who went through what he calls a hellish 15 years of torture, how he broke out of it, and how Alternatives for Battered Women is trying to make life better for all of us. That's next hour.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Wealth Strategies Group at Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, offering financial planning strategies that are tailored to clients' needs. Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, investing in you.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, my guest for the hour as we talk about sexual assault on campus and the current and perhaps future legislation. Morgan Levy is University of Rochester's Compliance and Title IX Coordinator. Kate Cerulli is with the University of Rochester Susan B. Anthony Center for Women's Leadership and the Laboratory for Interpersonal Violence. And Chris Thomas is a partner with Nixon Peabody. Let's get back to the phones. And we have Adam and Phelps who's been waiting. Go ahead, Adam.
Hi. I'm a middle-aged man. I went to college in the late 70s, early 80s.
I was sexually attacked by a female. We were high on alcohol and drugs. Drugs may have been more prevalent back then. I don't know. And to be honest with you, it was not a good experience for me. I did get a sexually transmitted disease from her, but I honestly should not have put myself in that position. And I think a lot of people, male or female, should not learn things the hard way like I did. And my parents never had a talk with me about that stuff. I have talked to my sons and daughters about that at great length, but there is a responsibility for either person, obviously. We keep talking about the perpetrator, but and I, even though I was a victim, I'm not blaming myself, but if I hadn't put myself in that position, that would not have happened to me.
Adam, thanks for the call. Let's let our panel respond here. Morgan Levy?
I first want to say I'm so sorry that that happened to you. That shouldn't happen to anyone. And I'm hoping that you've had some healing experiences since that incident occurred. I think that colleges are better now at handling cases of sexual assault. I'm certainly much more aware that men can experience rape and sexual assault as well as women experiencing it. From my perspective, I think that everyone should be practicing safety in every aspect of their life. However, there should be no excuse for someone sexually assaulting another person. Just because someone was intoxicated or unfortunately found themselves in a place where they're incapacitated, that doesn't excuse the behavior of the other person who took advantage of that.
And, you know, I thank you so much for sharing your story. And I think it's important, your experience in terms of national prevalence. We know that the rates within year for a woman are 5.9% and for a man are 5%. So we're really talking about an equal opportunity crime in many ways when we're looking at lifetime histories and within year assaults, including within domestic relationships. And in November of 2014, the federal government said, you know, agencies providing care for these types of issues has to be able to address male victims as well. So I think we are going to see shifts in treatment paradigms to include men. But I just want to raise one issue in response to the caller's story, and that's that in most crimes, we don't ask what the victim's intent was. When we think about behaviors that are criminal in nature or assaults, we think about the perpetrator's mindset, what the perpetrator intended to do. And, you know, a victim who goes out on a date with a person and ends up being sexually assaulted, I think we have to be careful about victim blaming and putting onus on the victims.
Yeah, I would just say to Adam, if Adam were a friend of mine or if Adam was a child of mine, I would say, Adam, I've been drunk before and I have not been assaulted and I'm terribly sorry it happened to you. But and I think it's admirable that you're trying to view the entire picture and assess it. But lots of people are drunk and high, and they don't get assaulted, and no one should. Chris Thomas?
Here's, I think, one of the other very important things that Adam said. I've talked to my sons and daughters. That's what he said. And that's critical, Adam, in trying to break any sort of cycle and to educate your kids so that they aren't, they don't find themselves in the same situation mm-hmm. you found yourself in. So, kudos for that.
All right, let me get back to the phones. Line one in Rochester, John, is it Julie? Is that not Julie in Rochester? Go ahead, Julie.
Yes, this is Julie. I was sexually assaulted in college, and there was absolutely no alcohol involved. It was a very similar situation. I was at Fredonia. I was in a co-ed dorm, and I had done a year of community college, so the dorm I was placed in had some older students in the dorm. There was a girl's floor and a boy's floor. But I had returned back from Christmas break, and I had shared a bathroom with four other girls. And I was in the bathroom brushing my teeth. I returned to my room, and there was a guy in the room who locked me in my room, and I escaped barely. And I filed a police report. The police did nothing. They just swept it on the rug. They pretty much just called the guy and told him to leave me alone. And it was a guy that I had seen, passing in the halls and such, but I never did anything to warrant that type of incident. And the college did offer counseling, but like your guest, I tried to move to a single-sex dorm, but then I ended up transferring, and I left the college and went to a different college because it was very traumatizing. You know, I was sexually assaulted as well as a child. I had a eighth-grade teacher fill me up. I think sex in our society, it's men, for some reason, think it's okay. The boys will be boys mentality. And I think that as a woman, I've been subjected to many types of inappropriate advances and such.
Well, Julie, let me just first of all jump in and say thank you very much for the call. And of course, you know, I think everyone here hates to hear about that kind of experience. The question that we're trying to establish this hour is what is changing, what has been changing. And I think, Morgan Levy, that at least, you know, I don't want to speak to her case specifically, but I think the macro, we're seeing more reporting and more campuses, I think, putting this issue out front. I would be surprised, and maybe I'm naive, but I would be surprised to hear today too many cases like Julie's happening. I would hope that it doesn't.
Absolutely. I think that there's a lot more awareness on college campuses that this is an issue that needs to be addressed really thoroughly and critically. There's very specific guidelines that the Department of Education has proliferated for colleges and universities about how they can comply with Title IX. And they include very specific guidance about what to do when someone comes forward and says that they've experienced an assault, including helping folks find another residence if they don't feel comfortable staying in that residence, like Julie had mentioned, accessing counseling and other interim and measures to help make sure that someone can still engage in their educational program, which is what Title IX is all about, is making sure that, that students can still engage in their educational activities and get the benefits from their education. So I do think that it has been a positive change over the past 2 or 3 years. There's certainly more robust attention on college campuses whenever a complaint comes forward.
Chris Thomas?
Julie used a term that I think captures a lot of the story here, and that's boys will be boys. And I think that there has been that attitude, not just on college campuses, and this is grossly generalized speaking, okay? But there has been, you know, that sort of approach in society generally. But I think that really began to change in September of 2013 when, especially for SUNY, you know, I think Julie said she was at SUNY Fredonia. Mm-hmm. And it was in September of 2013 that SUNY entered into a voluntary resolution agreement, which basically means the Office of Civil Rights for the Department of Education did an investigation of SUNY and said, hey, guess what, SUNY? We don't think you're doing things very well as it relates to sexual violence. And the SUNY system entered into this voluntary agreement with the Office of Civil Rights of the Department of Education that laid out a very specific set of steps that SUNY needed to undertake in order to make its campuses safer for people like Julie and for people like Adam. And so I think that at least in the SUNY system, and I think most of the private schools, and by the way, I think most of the private schools in this area do a dynamite job. The needle, I think, as Kate was saying, has been moving away from that boys will be boys mentality to one that says, you know, people like Adam and people like Julie are entitled, and not just morally entitled, but legally entitled to be safe on the campus. And these are the ways we're going to move the needle away from the boys will be boys mentality.
Okay, let me grab one more phone call if I could, and then we're going to try to get to, we're going to make sure we understand what's happening and what's going to happen going forward here with sexual assault on campus legislation. John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, I've got a really practical question. What is consent? What constitutes consent? What does it look like? Because the more I hear this conversation, not just on the show, but generally, it seems that consent is this elusive, murky thing. And me as a male, I would love to know what actually constitutes consent, because, I mean, I think I know what constitutes consent. It's a woman consenting, saying yes. But I see cases, and I hear certain conversations where it seems that consent is just a nebulous kind of murky thing.
Yeah, it's a good question, John. Thanks for the call. Chris, you immediately grabbed a stack of notes there. Go ahead.
That's what we lawyers do. We take a look at what the legislation says. And there's currently pending in the New York State Assembly a bill that's been introduced by Assemblywoman Glick, who is the chairwoman for the Committee on Higher Education. And one of the first sections of this law is the definition of consent. And I'll just read it to you because it tells you where we're headed.
Yep.
Okay, this has not yet been enacted. Affirmative consent is a clear, unambiguous, knowing, informed, and voluntary agreement between all participants to engage in sexual activity. Consent is active, not passive. Silence or lack of resistance cannot be interpreted as consent. Seeking and having consent accepted is the responsibility of the person or persons initiating each specific sexual act, regardless of whether the person initiating the act is under the influence of drugs or alcohol. It goes on a little bit longer than that, but that's the gist of it right there. It's a very active and an ongoing, basically minute by minute, process whereby if one of the parties uses a safe word or says or pushes back, or even if they retreat, so to speak, the party that's initiating needs to stop and say, hey, are we okay here?
And Kate Cerulli, it sounds to me that there are at least some questions, John's and others, about whether that it is realistic for people to come to that kind of consent agreement. But I think you've been saying maybe it's a cultural shift in expectation, but it's not altogether unrealistic that two parties would reach that kind of consent?
Right, and have that discussion. I talked earlier about, the intent of the perpetrator versus the intent of the victim. And when you think about these cases that come forward, we're talking about the tip of the iceberg, right? These are cases where there's been allegations, not the unreported cases that come forward. So when we're talking about consent not being given freely or voluntarily, we're really talking about these cases that surface to the judiciary on these college campuses. We're not talking about the cases that there might be, a conversation or there isn't, and the kids are going back and forth and they're not sure exactly where things are leading. But, one of the things I want to point out with this perception of reporting or false reporting or what women or men are saying is happening to them as victims. These cases, I was having a conversation this weekend with a friend named Meg, and she's a former prosecutor. And one of the things I want to point out, these cases are unlike any other type of college crime, because when you think about bikes being stolen or property or equipment being lifted or cell phones being stolen, we are talking about the crime scene being one's body. It is a completely different phenomena. Systems are not necessarily created to address these types of crimes when your body is the crime scene.
Well, I have to ask then, because NPR has reported on other campuses around the country. And for example, they talked to Juna Perkins, who's a former prosecutor who's now an investigator for hire focusing on sexual assault just outside Boston. And Juna Perkins says there's a growing number of campuses reaching out to her saying, we need you to do this. This is not our expertise. Let's bring in a former prosecutor. Let's bring in a professional investigator. And she said she's happy to do it. She does have the experience. And Morgan Levy, should we see more campuses go in that direction, or can campuses handle this?
I think that some campuses would really benefit from getting an outside investigator to come in and really look at any sexual assault case. It's really going to depend on the internal resources of that institution. So larger kind of research one level universities may be able to investigate these cases on their own because they have people with that expertise and training already within their entity. But a small private school, 2,000 students, they may not have those same resources. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really helpful if they can get an outside investigator to come in and make a report about those cases.
All right, about 90 seconds left here. For our listeners, we've been talking about changes with sexual assault procedures on campus. Started on December 2nd. It's easy to find. If you Google it, the governor's website, they rolled it out. They'll give you line by line what SUNY kind of codified in December. And now the question is whether the state will codify that and make it law that all institutions, even private institutions, have to do that. Kate Cerulli, do you think that's going to happen this year?
I do. I think we're going to see a change. And for those who are listening, if you have been a victim and you're a survivor, thriver, please know there's help, and you can call our local rape crisis, which is Restore, 546-2777, and healing is available. And it's a long journey, but there's people who want to walk the walk with you.
Okay. And so there are resources out there. You can check. As Chris Thomas said earlier this hour, maybe you're a parent and you've got a child who's going to be going to school, et cetera. It's good to know, number one, what the law says, what the rules are, how it operates. And so, again, you could, it's easy to find if you Google it. This legislation, which has been debated, is potentially, we could see that go forward this year and make it more uniform. Last word from Morgan Levy. What do you want our audience to take with that going forward as we sort of evaluate these possible changes?
I think that the most positive thing that is coming out of this piece of legislation and other pieces of legislation that have been introduced over the past 2 years is that it's really getting people to engage in the conversation. At the University of Rochester, we have student groups that are really engaged in this topic now as a result of these changes.
Well, I know it's complex, and I hope that you will all come back and keep us informed. The legislative session ends in June, so we'll know by the end of June whether New York State will codify this across the state, not just in the SUNY system, but for private institutions as well. And we'll try to continue to answer your questions. Chris Thomas from Nixon Peabody, thank you so much, Chris.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Kate Cerulli, who's here from the University of Rochester, Susan B. Anthony's Women Leadership Center and Laboratory for Interpersonal Violence. Always good to see you. Thank you.
Thanks, Evan.
And Morgan Levy, Title IX Coordinator for the University of Rochester. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, short break, and we're talking about domestic violence more generally next hour. Stay with us.